This is Ken McLeod. Thousands of people around the world listen to these podcasts every week, just as you are doing now. If you find them helpful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. Your generosity helps us maintain and expand the website for the benefit of yourself and other practitioners worldwide. Thank you, and enjoy this podcast.
Unfettered Mind, Awakening from Belief, Part 4.
Okay. I'd like to start by hearing from you something about your experience with this practice. Pardon? I think speak up so everybody can.
It's like the concept that the karma is creating your own reality. It's like getting your interpretation of things that I've heard for years, but finally having it make sense, gel, or become operational.
Okay. Okay. But I want your experience. Ah, she hasn't quite got to the point yet.
This morning I went through kind of an emotional phase with dying and death and murder and about myself. And I was, you know, then after lunch I was just, forget it. I was tired and my mind was just, it wouldn't budge.
Right.
I just stuck like that. Yeah. And then in the second one, I sort of woke up and I was like, okay, let's try to market this. Forget murder, we'll go to gossip. And then, you know, and lying and all that. And so my mind starts going, well, you know, and I remember that. And when I said, look, motherfucker, just get on with it. You know, 1, 2, 3, let's go. Remember that time? And I said, okay, I'll talk. And I was going like a mantra, I think. Yeah, I remember that too, but I remember that. All right, now what's the result of that? What's accrued since then? A whole lot of pathetic, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so that's kind of the nature of the second hour.
Okay.
It was very effective because it wasn't the kind of like, oh, this is great, I'm really getting into this in the morning. And then the afternoon was like, oh, and then, like I say, when as soon as you get into the motherfucker phase of things,
okay.
For me.
Oh, I thought you were speaking for everybody. Okay, Terry.
I did all those things, you know, and probably many more. But when you gave me that point, I had an aha moment. And then I came back here and sat, and I had a lot of feelings that came up with it, feelings about reality, or what is reality, it's not reality.
I need another point. Yes.
I found it difficult to get into the feeling part during the meditation. I have no trouble when I'm driving down the road in the car.
Yeah.
Little resistance there, huh? Okay. Yes.
Difficult, very, a little bit depressing.
How so? you don't have to go into all the gory details,
well,
just some of them.
The detail, very I can't remember. But it was heavy. It was very hard. It was going back to it over and over. And then I didn't really know what the point was. I mean, conceptually, okay, you know, great. I won't repeat this stuff. But there was no, you know, I wasn't smiling.
Yes.
This morning I had this experience early on when I got up. I realized, oh, I'm supposed to sit. Right away, I looked at my watch, it was 8:05, 15 miles away. And I did some quick calculation. I can sit here, right, I can do it right now. So I just turned myself around in the bed and just did it. And I've never done that before. And the instructions actually came to me. I saw the Karmapa in the distance, which was a, my camera was coming in slowly, and I saw the bell and the wooden, and I had this experience of this effortless quality of just being naturally resting and then losing it, and not fighting to come back, and then having a feeling of wanting to stay with that forever. I can't remember having that before. And then by 3 o'clock this afternoon, I was nothing but trying. You know, by 3 o'clock this afternoon, I was nothing but trying to make things work. Nothing but forcing. And that's why I asked that. I found I had to really just shake it up a little bit.
Right.
Just really knock it around a little bit, loosen it up, and finally was able to loosen it.
Okay. Any other reflections with karma? Yes.
I felt a little like I was conceptualizing things a lot. And then one of the things that really hit me was it was very clear how things I was trying to get in the end, the world peace, and the things I'm trying to avoid are the things that end up coming. Yeah. It just was very clear, And after a while, because it was so clear, I kind of stopped experiencing like the emotions with it, because it was the way it is. I don't know. I felt more conceptual than
experiencing.
Okay. Leslie? I was feeling the point a little bit before I took action. And I had such a sense of that.
Isn't that wonderful?
No, it was kind of radical to see that. I think that's what the justification is a little bit before, because the action actually is kind of unconscious, and I don't think that there's any kind of realization, but the total clarity of righteousness happening beforehand really surprised me. And it was there in every case, you know. So then I went back and I looked at like the pressures prior to that had been like these things that were, you know, like, I think of them as geographical, you know, pressures moving against each other to get to the point of that sense of justification. And then this afternoon I was with regret, you know, which is like the end product of you be right back to the beginning. I think it was fascinating.
Okay. One more. Come on.
Because I dredged up a lot of stuff, and it was good to bring it up and actually look at it. It's difficult, but I look at it and get to see the pattern I'm looking. And then the fact of doing four things about getting rid of the pattern.
Yeah.
And I felt very good after that.
You felt lighter. Okay. Now, we're working on a very compressed time scale here. How many of you are familiar with the four thoughts that turn the mind, or the four reminders? Okay. This is the one on karma. This is actually how you're meant to do it. In LA, a group of my students formed an independent practice group. They spent a year, almost a year, on this practice. They did 2 weeks on the killing, and then 2 weeks on saving life, and then 2 weeks on stealing, and 2 weeks on generosity. And they worked through all of them like that. which is a very good way to do it, because then you begin to see the actual operation of the pattern in you on both sides, because you can be just as habituated to virtuous behavior as you are to non-virtuous behavior. And you begin to see, just as you described, how you try to get this, but by your own actions it just keeps moving away. And you're trying to avoid this and trying to avoid this, but through your own actions it keeps coming back. So those of you who felt a bit depressed, a bit sick, the common experience in doing these kinds of meditation is nausea. It's fundamentally different from the meditations on death and impermanence, for instance, where the basic emotional feeling that comes up is fear. This one is nausea. And it may be, as Kamal described, that as you see this, you're actually acknowledging things that you've more or less denied to yourself over a long period of time. And so you're coming to a different relationship with them. That's very important in terms of letting them go and being able to move into different behaviors. Leslie's comments about righteousness. I don't know whether any of you are familiar with a rather remarkable translation of, I guess it's the Iliad. I can't remember the author's, the poet's name, but it goes by the title of War Music. Anybody? I have the third volume with me, I can't remember. They're very thin, but it's describing the Battle of Troy. And some of you may be familiar with the myth, but at one point everything was about to be settled in a nice peace conference. And of course Pallas Athene didn't want this to happen at all, so she puts her energy into one of the Greeks, who has this brilliant idea that he's going to assassinate one of the Trojan nobles. And of course Pallas Athene's getting him to do this so that the war continues. But there's a wonderful line in there. It says, as he pulled his arrow, it just felt so right. And that's exactly the feeling that we have when we've gone through this whole process of rationalizing what we know through our own practice of awareness and presence is, this isn't the right thing to do, but the patterns take over and it just feels so right. This is the indication that we've been taken over. So the purpose, much of the purpose of this first phase of the practice that we're doing, is to get a feeling for how patterns take you over and run stuff in your life, and run very, very large sections of our lives. And start to appreciate that. And that as long as patterns are running those lives, then we're going to experience those four results. And they're self-reinforcing, as you could see. Did any of you notice that? How you start off doing this and it just reinforces. We had, remember in retreat, in the second retreat, one of the people that came, started the second retreat, was a very, very bright young Frenchman. He also had a little problem with anger. And he had been the treasurer of the main center and knew very well all the shenanigans that the head lama had run, and moving funds around and taking advantage of things and not being straight. And since he had a very strong moral ethic, he was really angry about this. And at the beginning of the second retreat, we were in retreat, we didn't have a lot of money, and we were also totally captive. We kept getting asked for money for this and money for that and money for this. It was a bit of a strain for some of us. And I found myself, because I would have conversations with them, feeling angrier and angrier. And I didn't like the head teacher of the center at all. Didn't think he was a terribly good person. I knew also some other shenanigans that he pulled. And so there I was, sitting in a retreat with all of this anger. And anger. And then one day I went, you know, this is just not doing me any good. I don't like what this is doing to me at all. I could feel it's like this black thing, you know, taking over my body or whatever. So I said, I don't care what he's done. I'm just not... I'm not dropping this because I don't think he's done wrong. I do, but I'm just going to stop harboring this anger. It's not doing me any good. Of course, my friend thought I'd betrayed him, and he wouldn't speak to me for a month. But I just dropped it because it wasn't doing any good. And this really is the point of these kinds of meditations. You become intimately acquainted with what the effect of your actions are on you. I mean, you know what they are on somebody else, but what are the effects of the actions you do on you and the way you experience the world and the way that it is possible for you to experience the world? And the more embroiled you get in these patterns, the more limited are your options for experiencing the world. Until the only way you can experience the world is through these very, very narrow windows where everything does not look very nice. And those narrow windows are called the six realms. You know, hungry ghost realm, hell realm, animal realm, human realm, titan realm, god realm. You know, they're very, very narrow. Yes?
Something that I think I will, the point that I would like your input. During the battle in World War II, a friend of mine took my place and was shot to death and bled to death in my arms. And then I cried uncontrollably. Blood all over me, and then I went forward with three other guys to destroy a machine gun nest that was putting us down. And I climbed into the mouth of a cave, and there were three Japanese soldiers there. And I killed them in a murderous rage. I could have taken them to prison. And at the time, I didn't think much of it. I went on with my murderous rage for several days after that, but it didn't trouble me. And yet, when I went to Japan after the war and I met the Japanese people, I realized how foolish they were and how wrong what I had done was. Suffice it to say that I drank for 17 years until I drank myself near to death. And I stopped drinking, and at some point subsequently, I turned my life over to trying to work against war and to alleviate poverty. And so for many, many years, I worked to try to make amends. And I haven't understood that until very recently, in just the last 24 hours, when murder was the subject. It's all been coming up for me, and I find it's very upsetting, and also that my life has been so shaped. So my question about the compassionate way is probably based on the fact that I believe thou shalt not kill is a true teaching. And to me, it's an absolute teaching, and I don't care about it. To me, it is, and I have paid dearly by my belief in that and my feeling that I've violated it in the worst possible way. And that all I can do is make amends. But I guess I'm sharing this partly because I want to be open, but also partly because I want to know how I can be a compassionate person without acting out of a deep sense of guilt and shame and the almost unforgivability of that act. say almost, because I lose a little bit of the girl, maybe somehow it can be forgiven. I can feel forgiven.
Well, thank you very much for your openness. I think it's... I think it adds a, or brings a, you know, a sense of concreteness to this discussion. You've done 3/4 of the job. You still hold on to an identity. That's the last quarter. I say 3/4 because your question brings to mind a teaching in the Tibetan tradition, which is called the Four Forces. You may already know them, I don't know. The Four Forces are how you stop the karmic process of evolution in your being. We cannot go back and undo what has happened. And when you make amends, it isn't really to undo or to set it back in order, because that's, I mean, a few situations that might be possible, but in most situations it isn't. And your example is very clear. You know, your buddy died in your arms, there's no undoing that, and you killed a number of people, and there's no undoing that. The four forces are, first, repudiation. And that is, by doing the kind of reflection that you clearly have done, and that we're doing here, we come to repudiate those actions, or that particular action. In this case, it is killing. You've repudiated it. It's wrong, period. Yes. Okay, regret is the other translation. Thank you for reminding me. Okay, the force of regret, then. That's actually better. The second, if you can remember all the terms I used, that's great. The second is the restitution or reparation or something like that. I haven't used, can't remember the term I used. And that is, and we do this not with the idea of undoing what we've done, but with the idea that we add to the karmic process something that takes us in a good direction. Remedial action. Remedy, that's right. Thank you. Somebody's read the book. So there's regret and renunciation, or resolve, and that's where you say, "I will not do this again." Okay. And the fourth one is, I know I didn't say repentance.
Raining?
No.
Raining.
Yeah. remorse we've already had. I was trying to translate them with all with ours, but I can't remember the ours that I used. It's all right. Yeah, there we are. There we are, is reliance. Because whenever we act unwholesomely, which for purposes we'll say is intentionally cause harm to others, to do so, we actually have to check out of awareness. And one of the original meanings of sin, the word sin, is that which separates you from God. So there's a similarity in from that perspective. So we have to come back into awareness. And we do that ceremonially or ritually by taking refuge, renewing our vows of bodhicitta and so forth, awakening mind. And you'll notice in this discussion there's no talk of forgiveness. And what I'm suggesting is that you're holding onto an identity of a person who's no longer here. You follow? And to come to know through your own experience that you are no longer that person is how you let go of that identity. But that person isn't here anymore. Now I can say that, that's my sense. But only you can know that. Okay. Susan? In theory, letting go of these identities is not so easy. And, the action happened. A process was initiated. That action is going to have consequences. Whatever happens, it's going to have consequences. Nothing can change that. The only thing we can do is not to continue the process of evolution. So whatever consequences have been set in motion, those happen, they play out, and nothing more takes their place. So I hesitate to say you no longer have the karma, because there are still things in motion that have to play out. And that's why I was having a little difficulty with that formulation. But when we can say, down that road, I no longer go, and know that that is the case, you have done everything that is possible.
Isn't that what the story of Milarepa really is all about? About very, very negative actions
renouncing yes. those actions and becoming a realized being mm-hmm. of
yeah.
life
thereafter. Yeah, it's that, and the turning point in Milarepa's story, you may recall, is when his black magic teacher attends or is asked to conduct the funeral for a patron of his. And he comes back and says to Milarepa, look, we all die. It's no sense adding to this by killing people with our arts. So either you stay here and take care of my wife and the estate, and I'm going to go off and practice the Dharma in order to, you know, remedy what we've done. Or you go off and I'll stay and take care of it because you have done it under my inspiration, it still will help me. Yeah. And we have these four reminders, you know, which Kala Rinpoche would teach quite literally ad nauseum. And when we were studying in Sanada with Rinpoche, you know, it'd be the precious human birth and death and impermanence, then karma, and then shortcomings of samsara, which is the six realms. And then we get past those and we get into some good stuff, you know. And then somebody new would show up. And as soon as somebody new showed up, Rinpoche always started at precious human birth. So I don't know how many times I heard these things. They already got in. The thing is, there's a reason why teachers always talk about these things. You know what it is? Nobody practices them. Nobody actually sits down and thinks about them in the way that I'm inviting you to do this weekend. Because when you really sit down and think about them, and think about them in the framework that I'm trying to present to you, okay, what do these actions do to the way you experience the world? Forget about doing good. Forget about being a holy person. Forget about getting enlightened. Forget about all of that stuff. When you speak harshly about somebody else and you do it on a repeated basis, what kind of world are you creating for yourself? A harsh world. Yeah. And when you lie, what kind of world are you creating for yourself? Yeah, a world where no one trusts you, no one listens to you. Well, and so you have to go to more and more extreme measures just to get through your life. You get locked into this cycle. This is what it does to you. Now, how many people actually sit down and think about this? And I remember I was talking with Trungpa Rinpoche a few years ago, and he said, you have your people meditate on death and impermanence for 8 months or a year? I said, yeah. They do it? I said, yes. I said, we could never get them to do it. Yeah. That's why they keep talking about it. Now, in the first stages of Dharma practice, how many of you have trouble with your motivation in Dharma practice? Okay? Good number. Do you know why? Yeah, I haven't spent enough time with these. Because if you're having trouble with your motivation in your practice, if you're having trouble practicing consistently, most of the time, I won't say all the time, but most of the time, it's because you don't know why you're practicing. Now, as I said, I think last night, maybe this morning, that's all a kind of blur. The powerful answers that Buddhism provides to questions of the spirit can overwhelm the stammering voice which is asking the questions. It is absolutely essential you know what your questions are. Now, they may or may not be the same as Buddha's. What was Buddha's question? What was the question that he could not get out of his mind, which led him to give up his heritage as a kingdom? Yeah. It was suffering. How can there be suffering? How can you live with suffering? This was his question. If we don't do anything else this weekend, but you get to find your question, that will be a huge... Maybe it will change the focus of it.
Does this translate into, how can a loving God have a world that is so yucky?
Well, this is the difference between Buddhism and Christianity.
You can ask that question.
Yeah.
We're supposed to have a loving God.
Well, this is the central problem of Christianity. C.S. Lewis wrote a very nice little pamphlet on it, which you can probably still get, called The Problem of Pain. And it characterizes very nicely the difference between Buddhism and Christianity. In Christianity, at least at the popular level, and to get into it in greater depth, it changes a bit, there's the supposition that there's an all-loving, all-powerful God. Yeah. And now pain is a problem. And that's what you say, well, how can this be? And that's what everybody asks when there's tragedy in the world and says, how can God do this? That's what everybody asks.
Loving God.
Yeah. Yes, the early Testament God isn't the early Old Testament. It's not exactly the Lord thy God is a jealous God, visiting with iniquity the sins of the fathers unto the children, nigh unto the seventh generation. Yeah. Well, actually, that has another meaning, but I'll go into that later. However, in Buddhism, what's your starting point? There is suffering. Not how can there be suffering? There is. Okay? Yeah, I mean, that's it. There is suffering. Okay? And the question in Buddhism is, what are you going to do? There is suffering, what are you going to do? And there's no notion of, how can this be ontologically? It doesn't make sense. So, in that sense, it's very straightforward. And that's why Buddhism, I say, isn't about belief. It's not, do you believe in suffering? I was asked to give a presentation, or asked to come to a sixth grade class, middle school, many years ago, and the class had been divided up into groups, and each group was doing a report on one of the religions, and they wanted someone who was in each of the faiths. So they had somebody from Islam and somebody from Christianity and Judaism. I was the Buddhist rep. So the sixth grader, the group got up and they gave this talk about how Buddhists believe that life is suffering, etc., etc., etc. And these are all people living in, all children living in one of the wealthy areas of L.A., and Santa Monica and Brentwood and so forth. And so at the end of the presentation, I said, well, Buddha said that life is suffering. Do you buy it? And they just went, nope.
Not yet.
And that's it. But
that your whole talk,
no, I wasn't giving a presentation. I was just there. I was just, nope. So, there's no cell there. And if you have to be in touch with your own suffering, your own pain, that's what drives your practice. That's what drove Buddha's practice. That's what drives our practice. I have this donkey, the carrot and stick theory of practice. Okay, you have a donkey, and you have the carrot approach to getting the donkey to move, and you have the stick approach. Now, how does the carrot approach work? You hold this carrot out, okay? And when the donkey starts to move, what do you do with the carrot? You move it, and you keep moving it, right? And where is the donkey's attention? On the carrot, okay? So he never gets the carrot, and that's where his attention is. Then there's the stick approach. You get a nice, firm stick, and you go, whack! And the donkey starts to move. Now, where's the donkey's attention? In the pain. What do you do when the donkey's moving? All right. And where's the donkey's attention? In his body, right? So, which approach brings you more into presence? Pardon?
Depends on your appetite.
Well, there is that. Right. But our suffering, in terms of our spiritual practice, is our friend. Yes?
I'm going to get something here. What I heard you say is false. It has to be personal for it to be universal.
Right.
I mean, you know, my daughter used to say, how do I write an essay that I'm having a problem here? And I say, always start with the personal, and then the general will flow. So is that what you're saying? And that's the importance of this practice. Because I think it's one of the problems of having spiritual things of all kinds through our watching people and saying, I know them personally. I know things about them. I'm always wondering when that's dealt with, you know. Not that they have to deal with it for me, but I'm just saying it becomes just hard to conflict.
Well, now we go into a whole other area. But what the heck? Pardon? Foolish? No, the thing is that, as you say, we all know people who are highly regarded spiritually whose behavior is questionable, so we say. And this is something I usually talk about with Buddhist teachers and I'm training or mentoring. But it applies to all of us. Buddhism is a completely ruthless form of spiritual practice. Any area of your life that you protect from your practice will take you over. Any area of your life that you protect from your practice will take you over. And so it's the individual's responsibility to bring attention to every area of their life. And if they don't, their practice is not complete. You may recall from the 7 points of mind training, deep and pervasive training is essential. And there's another one which says, you know, don't be prejudiced. Your practice has got to cover absolutely every area. And that gets real uncomfortable. We can't hide anything. And as I say, in the context of Buddhist teachers, which when I've observed teachers that have run into trouble, and I started teaching in the mid-80s, and it was, you might say, the flame-out period for Buddhist teachers. Mizumi Roshi, and I don't know, there are a bunch of others around the same time. Baker Roshi, and in every one of those instances, one of the key factors was that there was no one giving feedback to that teacher. They were isolated. And in being isolated, they were able to protect areas of their life from their practice, and no one could bring it to their attention. They'd created that situation. Talk about creating and bringing what you're trying to avoid. And so one of the consequences of that for me was that the whole time, from the time I started teaching, and I continue this with today, is that I always have one or two people in my life, usually two, but always at least one, from whom I have no secrets. I hate it sometimes, but it's been absolutely essential for me. I have absolutely no secrets, so there's nothing I'm hiding inside me, and so I can't hide from it. Oh yeah, and that's what they're there for, and I made that very explicit with them, and that's our arrangement. You know, what are you up to now, Ken? Well. Yeah, and it's been very, very important. So I don't know how many of you are in teaching positions, but if you are, it is something I strongly recommend. It has to be someone not only from whom you have no secrets, but whom you will listen to no matter how crazy you might be. Yes?
I read that in your book. You know, and the thing about it is, it's like any place where you're detecting practice, that assumes that I don't know what it is. If I'm protecting it from my awareness, I'm not that aware of it.
You may or may not know it. It can be either way.
So if I don't know, how can I know if somebody else can know? Come on, parents. I mean, of course, there are people who do.
Yes.
Okay, but, you know, I thought, from a practical point of view, I have had a certain instructor that I see once a month. More ideas about this?
Well, how much do you let him or her rummage around in you?
I have learned from being burned that it's best to steal my gut.
In the other day, in having a class on Tuesday evenings, one person was saying she was running into a problem with her equanimity meditation. And I could tell just by the way that she was phrasing the question that she was terrorists. I said, okay. But that's what she was protecting, her hatred of terrorism.